Okay. We can begin.
Yes.
Next week it's going to be a couple of TV screens.
No. You got to give me at least 3 weeks for that.
3 weeks?
You know what? I can't do everything.
I want a PowerPoint presentation.
It's not happening. Well, at least not in Kohelet. But you can't use PowerPoint in Kohelet. Ein chadash tachat haShemesh. You can't use cutting edge technology in Kohelet. It doesn't work.
The whole thing is about power.
That's true. That is true. First of all, a yeshikach to Mishpachat Wolf for helping to organize and making it possible for us to have a real professional whiteboard. Says it doesn't take much to make me happy. Give me a whiteboard and that's it. Second of all, in honor of the Yahrzeit tonight, we're going to dedicate the learning this evening to the memory of Reuven ben Chaim Shabtzai Leib, Mishpachat Raskus, and the Mishpachat Helman. So, Yeshivach to them, and long life, and all our learning should be Le'ilui Nishmato, and the benefit of the entire Mishpach. All right. Where did we leave off? I'm not mistaken. We left off with a question. Correct? Is that where we ended last week, with a question? What was the question?
I'm not testing you.
How do we live in the shadow of death? That's Kohelet's question. Right. Our question is, what is driving this man? What is pushing him? What is behind, what is the background to the philosophical quest that Kohelet is on? The suggestion story that you made last week, is he trying to play God? What exactly is this the driving force behind this philosophical desire to understand the world? That's one piece of the question. And at the same time, the question is, what's frustrating? Really, at the core, is there a single issue that is frustrating Kohelet and that ultimately makes each of his efforts in the various domains and areas of his philosophical quest, is there a specific issue that's frustrating the entire effort that underlines the whole sefer? That's the question, and tonight's year, tonight, maybe next week as well, depending on how much we get done, is really dedicated to uncovering that background. So we've reached that point in our beginning of our study of Kohelet where I call it the turning point. I want to address the real, what I believe to be the real crux of the underlining issue. And at that point, once we have that on the table and understand the pieces, it'll make our study of the rest of Kohelet a lot easier. We saw last week, we looked at various arenas of Kohelet's life, and what seems to be, this is already a number of times we've identified this, but we'll do it again for the sake of completion, three arenas that seem to be the focus of all of his efforts. One is concept of building, what he calls the amal, the other, or ma'asim, the second,
wisdom,
and thirdly, pleasure, hana'ah, or simcha. Those are the three arenas of his life. And last week we looked briefly various parts of Solomon's own historical life, his construction effort, certainly his wisdom and his philosophy, his drive for enjoying the world, and we looked at various components of his life in that light to see that these are not just an arbitrary three pieces, but that they are in fact part of the identity of Shlomo's own experience. And all of them are frustrated by a similar undercurrent. Namely, let's take a look, for example, at Chochma, Pasuk Tetvav, Perek Bet Pasuk Tetvav, verse 15. Amarti ani b'libi, chapter 2, verse 15. Amarti ani b'libi ki mikre aksil gam ani yikreni, v'lama chachamti ani az yoter. I said in my heart that at the end the fate of the fool will come to me as well, and therefore why did I bother becoming wise? What essentially is he alluding to? What is he saying? That he's going to die. And if he's going to die, then all of the wisdom that he's amassed is irrelevant. Even the memory, even his legacy. He talks about the fact that people in the generations to come are not going to remember that which he has established. Ki ein zichron lachacham im haksil li'olam. They won't even remember the wise, the chacham. Hakol nishkach ve'ech yamut chacham im haksil. Everything is forgotten, and how can the wise possibly? How it's unfair that the wise, the philosophical, the philosopher, the intellect, should die the same death as the fool. Similarly, with regards to Amelut, Pasuk Yudchet, V'saneti ani et kol amali, shani amel tachat hashamesh, I despised all of my effort and toil that I toiled under the sun, she'anichenu la'adam she'yeh acharai. I should have to leave it to the one who comes after me. All of the effort, everything that I've built, everything that I've created, I should have to give it to somebody else, to the one who comes after me. Ultimately, what destroys his quest for wisdom is death. And what destroys his quest for building and construction and putting his legacy on the world is death. And in this context, he tells us something which is really quite frightening. Really quite frightening. She'anichenu la'adam she'yeh acharai. Who is the Adam she'yeh acharav? Who is it who is going to inherit Solomon?
His son.
And how does he call his son? Adam she'yeh acharai. Is that how you would refer to a son? The one who comes after me?
Everything could be left to somebody who overthrew the government and took everything away.
So what you're suggesting, which is very important, what you're suggesting is that this is maybe more than just a philosophical issue. That may be what's underlining Shlomo's obsession with death is a historical issue. He may be looking at a specific issue that's driving this problem. And that is an approach that is taken in one of the Midrashei Chazal, in the Targum, and I have it on last week's source page. So if you have last week's source page, it's one of the last sources I didn't get to, but I'll translate it, so you'll if you don't have it, just listen carefully. On this verse, Saneti ani et kol amali, I've despised all of my possessions. She'anichenu la'adam she'achavai, that I should leave it to the one who comes after me. On this verse, the Targum translates this verse as follows: De ishavkine l'rechavam bri, that I should have to leave it to Rechavam, my son. The ati batrai, who will come after me. V'yayti Yeravam avdei, and Yeravam benevat, his servant, will come. V'yasef min yadoi ashtere shiftaya v'yachsin palgut malchuta, and will take from him 11 tribes and leave him
with half a kingdom. What is the end of Solomon's legacy? What happens historically, post-Solomon?
The division of the kingdom.
The division of the kingdom. The division of the kingdom is the end result of a process. Forgetting the prophetic perspective of the process for a moment, leaving that aside, there is a political process that's taking place in Solomon's own kingdom. It's hard for a man even as wise as King Solomon to have an insight into the wisdom of the Navi. The Navi works by a separate set of sources of information. But it's not hard for a father to see his son's nature and to possibly foresee the kind of king that his son is likely to be. So before we get to the theological issue of Solomon's wives and ultimately why the kingdom was split on a theological level, what happens politically is very significant. What are the sequence of events that happens at the end of Solomon's life? So take a look briefly at Malachim Aleph, Book of Kings, starting with chapter 12. Just a smattering of sources on the issue. Starting the Perek Yudbet, chapter 12. Lechem Aleph. Starting with the beginning of chapter 12. Vayelech Rechavam Shechem ki Shechem ba ko Yisrael amnichoto. Solomon dies and his son Rechavam takes the throne. Goes down to Shechem. They make a big ceremony of his coronation in Shechem. In the meantime, there is this guy, Yeravam ben Nevat. Now, who is Yeravam ben Nevat? Yeravam ben Nevat was a... Who is Yeravam ben Nevat? So a little bit of background on Yeravam ben Nevat is important. Go back to chapter 11 for a moment. Yeravam ben Nevat Ephrati. This Yeravam ben Nevat from Ephrat, or Ephrati means it from Shevet Ephraim. Chapter 11, verse 26, Pasuk Chavav. Yeravam ben Nevat gives you a zichus a little bit. One of the rare instances where his mother's name is mentioned. Eved Lishlomo. He's a slave. He's one of Solomon's servants, slaves. Vayarim Yad Bamelech. And he raised his hand against the king. He begins to rebel. He's an Eved, and he doesn't like to be an Eved. And he began somewhat of a quiet rebellion against King Solomon. Vezeh Adavar Asher Harim Yad Bamelech. This was the story of this rebellion. Shlomo Banat Hamilos Agarat Peretz Ir David Aviv. Amongst the many construction efforts that Solomon had engaged in, we saw last week, was to fix up all of the places of his father. Ya'ish Yeravam Gibochayel. This Yeravam, he was a strong person. Vayar Shlomo Tanar Ki Yoseh Melachahu. Solomon saw that he was very capable. He was a young, strong, capable man. Vayafgedoto l'chol sevel Beit Yosef, and he appointed him in charge of the sevel Beit Yosef. What's the sevel Beit Yosef? Sevel Beit Yosef is the labor force of the children of Yosef, Ephraim and Manasseh, the slaves, so to speak, that Solomon had or taxed the people to help build his construction efforts. Remember I said last week that despite the fact that in one place it says that his builders were all foreigners. The reality is that there are enough, clearly there were enough Jews laboring under Solomon's construction efforts for it to be a problem, and Yeravam was put in charge of this effort. He was in charge of several Beit Yosef. You can even hear the description, you can hear the anguish in the word Sevel. This isn't just a workforce, this is an oppressed workforce, a suffering workforce. And we'll see with Rechavam, that becomes very significant. The rest of the story with Achia Shilani, we're going to skip for now. We'll come back to it a little bit.
Was Yosef just the tribe? Who
is Beit Yosef? It's an interesting question. Who is Beit Yosef? It could be the tribes of Yosef. In this case, it's more likely it's a reference to all the tribes outside of Shevet Yehuda. The division between Shevet Yehuda and the rest of the tribes of Israel is an old division. It goes back to Sefer Shoftim. We're used to thinking of the division of the kingdom as a post-Solomon phenomenon. It's not. The references, the description, the terms of Yehuda versus Yisrael appear already in their roots in Sefer Shoftim. And certainly in Sefer Shmuel directly, in the relationship between David and Saul. And you have what ended up happening with the split of the kingdom is that that natural fault line finally gave. And you had a split of the kingdom, but it's an old fault line. So Sevel Beit Yosef is essentially, or Beit Yosef could be a reference to essentially all the tribes who followed the leadership of Ephraim going back to the days of Yoshua, and Shevet Yehudah by himself. Subject for another discussion, which is how Binyamin ends up in the picture and the role that Binyamin plays. Binyamin shifts loyalties from Yisrael to Yehuda, and that's a subject of a different, that's a shir into itself. Then, so this Yeravam ben Nevat has a history. Solomon sends him into exile, he sees him as insubordinate, he doesn't like it, so he sends him into exile, he sends him down to Egypt. In the meantime, Solomon dies, Rechavam takes over the throne, and in chapter 12, going back to chapter 12, verse 2, Pasuk Bet, Vayhi kishmo Yeravam ben Nevat, ruadenu b'mitzrayim. This Yeravam ben Nevat, who's in political exile now in Egypt, because Shlomo had exiled him, Asher barach mipnei melech Shlomo, he ran because of Solomon, Vayeshav Yeravam b'mitzrayim, he had been living in Egypt all these years, Vayishlechu vayikru'u lo. So his followers called him back. Solomon's no longer here. Now it's time to return from exile. Vayavo Yeravam b'chol kahal Yisrael, vayedabru al Rechavam lemor. So Yeravam comes together with his followers from Israel, and they speak to Rechavam, saying, Avicha hikshat uleinu. Your father oppressed us. He put a terrible yoke or burden upon us. What burden? Sevel Beit Yosef, this burden of construction. Ata hakel mi avodat avicha hakasha, umeula hakaved, ashenatan aleinu v'na'avdecha. If you will but lighten the load or the yoke from upon our shoulders, then we will be loyal to you and we will serve you. Rechavam says to them, Vayomer alehem luchu od shloshet yamim v'shuvu elai v'yalchu ha'am. He says, give me 3 days to think about it. Vayve'etz ha'melech Rechavam et azkinim asher yu omdim et pnei Shlomo aviv yato chai. So Rechavam took counsel. He took counsel with the elder statesmen of his advisors, the ones who were around when his father was king, and said to them, Ech atem no'atzim lashiv et ha'am hazeh davar. Tell me, what counsel do you give? What should we do? So they said, Vaydabru elav lemor, im hayom tiye eved la'am hazeh, va'avadtem va'anitem v'dibarta alehem dvarim tovim v'yu lecha avadim kol hayamim. If you will submit yourself to these people and buy their loyalty, they will be your loyal servants all their days. But you need to prove yourself to them. So he said, okay, thank you, elder statesman, very much for your advice. Vayiva'atz et hayiladim asher gadlu ito asher ha'omdim lefanav. And he took counsel with the kids who grew up with him, with his peers. Vayomer aleihem, and he said to them, Ma'atem no'atzim v'nashiv davar ta'am hazeh. What do you say? Asher dibru alei lemor akel min ha'ol asher natan avich aleinu. What do you say to this request of the people to lighten the burden? So the young kids who grew up with him said to him, thus you shall say to the people, my pinky is wider than my father's thigh. My father put a terrible yoke upon you. I will add to that yoke. My father smote you with rods. I will set that with a staff, with a stick. I will get you with scorpions. How dare you? Yeah, chutzpah, come to me and ask me to lighten your burden. Go make bricks without straw. Oh, sorry, wrong story. No. Rechavam, wise king of Israel, which etzah did he take? Yeah. Right. His peers said exactly what he said, what they told him to say to Yeravam ben Nevat, who was just called back from political exile and has the sympathy of all the people with him. And within a very short period of time, Yeravam ben Nevat is leading the northern kingdom of Israel, 10 tribes, leaving Rechavam with his two. There's a war between them. Battle doesn't end well. Navi says to him, go home, don't even fight this battle. Rechavam is stuck. All because he took counsel with the wrong people. Now, Solomon is looking at all of this, min ha-shamayim. Solomon is no longer around. But the Medrash does something fascinating. And the Medrash says that when Shlomo Melech is writing Kohelet, and he's talking with pain about all of the effort and all the toil and all the building and all the construction and all of this, the accomplishments of his masterful empire, that I have to leave it to the one who comes after me, says the Medrash. It doesn't take much for Solomon to be able to foresee the foolishness with which Rechavam is likely to lead these people. He doesn't have his father's wisdom. He doesn't have his father's political sensitivity. And Solomon is at the end of his life looking at the legacy of what's to come next. And what's to come next is Rechavam ben Shlomo Melech b'Yisrael. And what's to come next to King Solomon is the devastation and the destruction of his entire kingdom. Solomon built the largest empire, or Solomon inherited, the largest empire in biblical history, perhaps. There's some debate as to whether or not King Saul reigned over a larger empire. But certainly one of the greatest, if not the greatest, empire. Certainly had the largest political influence over any Jewish king before or after. In the last 5 years of his life, in the aftermath of the Nevuah of Achia Shilani with his wives and the idolatry that he allowed into his kingdom, etc., he already begins to lose that kingdom. There's already skirmishes around his kingdom that are eating away at the land, at the territorial breadth of his kingdom. And he's looking at Rechavam, Prince Rechavam, Crown Prince Rechavam, as his future. And the Och Inveitu, King Solomon's mind said, if that's his future, some whippersnapper kid who's going to take over his kingdom, and within 5 years of the largest empire in biblical history, within 5 years, that empire is going to go up in smoke. It will lose its territorial breadth. It will lose its political stature. It will lose its economic strength. the strength of the economy of Israel, then and today, the strength of the economy of Israel is because it sits on a landmass that is the central axis of the trade routes of the ancient Middle East. Remember the story of Yosef coming down, right? Ochat Yishmaelim taking down, where is to Egypt? I don't have a map of Israel. Okay, B'zat Hashem, next week we add a map of Israel to the equipment. But I'm going to embarrass myself now. I do not draw maps well. That is my wife's department. Something like that. Give or take. It's not quite the scale. But if this is Syria and Jordan and Iraq and Saudi Arabia, this is Mesopotamia, and this is Egypt, there are two major trade routes in the ancient Middle East. One goes down the Jordan Valley, called Derech HaMelech, and the other goes up the coast. It's referred to in the Torah as Derech Eretz Plishtim. These are the two major trade routes, north and south. The only problem is, two parallel roads never meet. And if you want to get your wares from Mesopotamia to Egypt or vice versa, somehow you have to traverse these two roads. Where do you cut across? The axis route across is Emek Yisrael and the area of Shechem. That's the power of Emek Yisrael. That's why Emek Yisrael was the central point, the central place of all the battles in Sefer Shoftim. For 300 years, the enemies tried to take Emek Yisrael because it controlled the trade routes. If you sat in Emek Yisrael, you controlled everything. And if you taxed one penny per pound of everything that traveled these roads, you could make a fortune. And if Israel was used as the trade route of the Middle East today, every barrel of oil being shipped from the Middle East to the West would go through Israel. Can you imagine what a tax per barrel would give Israel in the economy? Israel doesn't need the oil. All it needs is the tax on the trade. Because right now they have to ship all the oil around like this to get it anywhere. It would have been so much easier to put one pipeline straight across the Mediterranean. The power of Israel's economy rests in its contiguous territorial contiguity. Let's do that again. Territorial contiguity. Is such a word? Did I make that up? I don't know. I think there's a word like that. Going from northeast to southwest. Now take the kingdom of David and Solomon, which was the wealthiest kingdom in Jewish history because it sat on this large landmass and split it down the middle. These are now two kingdoms. There's no trade between them. There's no diplomatic relations between them. They're at war with each other. What does it do to the economy of both? All of this Solomon foresees, if not the details of it, but the potential. The empire, the legacy that Solomon had built is going to be put into the hands of this Rechava. Says the Medrash, "De'ishavkine l'Rechavambri, I should have to leave it to Adam Sheyacharai, this kid, this Rechavam, this nothing, who's going to destroy everything I created and amassed." So yes, Solomon would love to live forever if he could avoid putting Rechavam in his throat. So certainly I think that's one level of what's eating at Shlomo HaMelech. The end of his life is not a happy ending. He's already foreseen, he's already experienced some of the breakdown of his kingdom. At the end, when the Navi says that there are three things that will destroy his kingdom as a punishment by God, two of them he already sees in his lifetime. And one is this, the territorial breakdown of his empire and the conquest of the lands to the north, to the northeast. And he's already foreseeing that all of his toil and all of his effort is breaking down.
But that may explain some of his end-of-life frustration. It doesn't necessarily explain what's driving or motivating the search, the quest, because I don't think it's a search or a quest that starts at the end of his life. Kohelet may be the culmination, maybe his conclusion, but I don't think this laboratory of life starts in the last 5 years of his existence. The tone of Kohelet is that these are his conclusions of a lifetime of exploration. So the question that I have on a historical context, if we're already addressing the question from that perspective, is why does he start on this historical, on this philosophical quest? Where does it stem from? Where is it starting? So for that, we're going to go back in time. Turn to Melachim Aleph Perek Gimel, chapter 3. And for the next week or two, we're going tonight and next week, we're going to take a look at the early part of Solomon. Where does it all begin? Solomon's life essentially begins in chapter... Solomon's reign begins in chapter 3. Chapters 1 and 2 are a postscript to the book of Shmuel. Chapters 1 and 2, Shlomo comes to the throne. David had a couple of unfinished tasks that he left him to do. So Shlomo goes off and he does them. A couple of assassinations that he needed to take care of and people that needed to be punished for insubordination to King David. Take care of some loose ends of his father's business, and his legacy, his reign, his life begins in chapter 3. Even if you take a look at the very last phrase of chapter 2, after he kills these two people that David told him to kill, v'hamamlacha nechona biyad Shlomo. The kingdom was established in the hands of David. He's now king. His first act as king, his first official act as the newly instated king of Israel, is something to which Chazal take great offense at and critique him terribly. Vayitchaten Shlomo et Paro melech Mitzrayim, vayikach et bat Paro. First thing he does as the newly appointed king of Israel is he marries the daughter of Pharaoh. Obviously, if his largest empire on his border is Egypt, the smartest thing for him to do is to marry the daughter of Pharaoh, which is, from the perspective of the Navi, the stupidest thing for him to do. But that's what I said. Political cheshbonos and the Navi's cheshbon are not always on the same page. Vayaviel ir David ad kalato livnot et beito, v'et Beit Hashem, v'et Chomat Yerushalayim Saviv. He put him in a temporary palace in in Ir David until he finished the construction of his house and the temple. Does that phrase... Yeah, there's something uncomfortable in that phrase. I agree. Rak ha'am zabchim babamot ki lo nivna bayit L'shem Hashem adayamim ahem, because the people are bringing offerings on their own personal altars, because the Mishkan is destroyed, and the temple had not yet been built. Vayehav Shlomo at Hashem lalechet b'chukot David aviv. Solomon loved God, and he walked in his father's ways. Rak ba'bamot hu mezabeach u'maktir. He only has one little problem, and it's the same problem that everybody has. He's got these private altars everywhere. So in order to begin the process of the building of the temple, he goes down to Givon. And in Givon there's a great bama, there's a great altar.
And he offers 1,000 sacrifices. It's really remarkable. 1,000 sacrifices. Looks like I don't have a clue. But he offers 1,000 animals on Korban that day. Maybe it took a day, maybe it took a week, I don't know how long it takes to offer 1,000 Korbanot, but nonetheless, he does. Ba'giv'on nira Hashem el Shlomo b'chalom alayla. And in Giv'on, God comes to Solomon in the middle of the night in a dream. What's the expression? Halavai af mir gesagt. God comes to him in a dream. Wait. Look what God says to him. Vayomer Elokim. And God says to him, Sha'al ma eten lach. Solomon, ask of me anything you like, and I shall grant it. Now, alavai af mir gezokt. Right? Now you really want to be in Solomon's shoes. Whoa, what an offer. God comes to Solomon at the tender age of 12, according to Chazal. 12, 13, 20. He dies at the age of 52. So Chazal says he's 12 years old when he comes to the throne, and he dies at the age of 52. How long he's already king when this happens is not clear, but he's certainly young. Has he proven himself? Not a lot. I mean, he's done what David asked him to do. He's taken out these two people. His first act as king was to marry the daughter of Pharaoh. I suspect he might be a little older than 12, maybe. But nonetheless, something hasn't proven much. God comes to him and he offers him the most remarkable offer you can imagine. Rub the genie and ask for 3 wishes. Rub the bottle, ask the genie for 3 wishes. God comes to him and he says, Sha'al ma eten lach. Solomon, ask of me anything you want. It's yours. On a silver platter. Free ride. Vayomer Shlomo, Solomon says, Ata asit et avdecha David avi chesed gadol. You, God, did a tremendous chesed for my father David. God, David, who was loyal to you, who walked before you in truth and righteousness and wholeheartedly. And you kept your promise to him. What was the promise? What was the great promise to David? That his son would sit on this throne. Vatiten lo ben yoshev al kiso kayom hazeh, and you gave him a son to sit on his throne today. What a tremendous chesed you did for my father David. Ata Hashem Elokai, Hashem my God. There's a personal closeness, as Solomon feels. Ata imlachtet avdechad tachat David avi, you put me on the throne, your servant, in place, in lieu of David, your servant, my father. Va'anochi nar katon, lo eda tzet vavo. And I am but a lad, a na'ar. That's what Chazal said, he was 12. Because a na'ar, halachically, is 12 years old. A na'ar can also mean a young man. But I am young. I don't understand how to go and come. How to go and come, by the way, is an expression for war. Latzet v'lavo is always an expression of battle. Hashem yishmor tzeitcha uvoecha me'ata v'yad olam. God should protect your going and coming. Atzeit v'lavo is a biblical expression for going to war. Because you go out and you come back. Hopefully. The idiom is always a reference to war. I'm not even a warrior. I'm a kid. Prerequisite to be a king is to be a warrior. David was a warrior. Solomon was a spoiled kid. He was a spoiled, I won't say brat, but he was a spoiled prince. What did he know about war? David learned the mikzoa of war on the being a shepherd in the fields, fighting the bear and the wolf. What does Solomon know from how to be a warrior? Avdecha betoch amcha shebacharta, am rav ashelo yimane v'lo yisafer merov. And your servant is now, finds himself amidst a multitude of people. innumerable people who can't be counted. So what am I going to do? How am I going to lead these people? So here's my request. V'natata la'avdecha lev shomea lishpot etamcha la'vin ben tov l'ra. I ask simply for an understanding heart to be able to judge your people, to understand the difference between right, between good and evil. Ki mi yochal lishpot etamcha hakaved hazeh? Who could possibly judge these people, your heavy people, this great people? One of the roles of a king is to be the judge, to be the adjudicator, to be the head of the court. The other role of the king is to be the warrior. Solomon knows he has no chance on the battlefield. Solomon never fights any battles. He never fights a single war. Doesn't need to. He fights a few at the end of his life, but not successful. Doesn't need to. He inherited the empire from his father. But he needs to be able to control such an empire. That requires
wisdom,
political sensitivity. That requires chachma. So what's his request?
Wisdom.
Lev tov. Let's do it again. Lev shomea lishpot etamcha. I'm going to translate it literally. Lev shomea lishpot etamcha lavin ben tov l'ra. A heart that can hear, can listen, because the part of the art of adjudication is the art of listening. Lev shomea lishpot etamcha, to be able to judge your people, lahavin ben tov l'ra, to understand the difference between good and evil. Vayitav adavar b'nei Hashem. This matter was good in the eyes of God. Ki sha'al Shlomo et hadavar hazeh, that Solomon asked for this thing. Vayomer Elokim elav, God said to him, Yan asher sha'alt et hadavar hazeh. The fact that this is because you have made this request. V'lo sha'alt lecha yamim rabim. You did not ask for long life. V'lo sha'alta lecha osher, you didn't ask for wealth. V'lo sha'alta nefesh oivecha, you didn't ask for your enemies in the battlefield. Sha'alta lecha havin lishmoa mishpat, you simply asked to understand, to be able to hear and adjudicate. Hine asiti kidvarecha, I will give you exactly what you asked. Hine natati lecha lev chacham v'navon asher kamocha lo haya lefanecha me'achanecha lo yakum kamocha. I give you a wise and understanding heart, the likes of which have never been before you nor will ever follow you. Now listen carefully. V'gam asher lo sha'alta, and that which you did not ask for, natati lech, I've given you that too. Gam osher, gam kavod. Wealth and honor. Wealth, honor, wisdom, you've got it all. Why? Why? Asher lo haya kamocha ish b'malachim ko yamecha. Unparalleled wealth, unparalleled honor, unparalleled fame, unparalleled power. All because Solomon asked for wisdom. So he gets his wisdom, and with it he gets that which he didn't ask for. If he didn't ask for it, maybe he doesn't want it. What?
Not a bad deal.
Not a bad deal for a guy who's 12 years old and hasn't done a stitch of work in his life. And if you will walk on my statutes and guard my commandments and my laws, kasher alach David avicha, as your father did, I'll give you long life too. You get it all. Wow. What a gift for a man who has done nothing. Now, we learn the story and we teach the story and we heard it from the time we were this big. We always perceive it as this great gift that God has given Solomon.
starts. Day one of his kingdom, the only thing he has done, period, in his whole life of any significance as king of Israel is to marry the daughter of Pharaoh, lo aleinu. God comes to him in a dream and he says, and God says, I give you the world, whatever you want, you ask it, I will grant it. And Solomon said, it's an unbelievable offer. And you have to scratch your head and ask yourself, why make the offer? What? Can't say what possessed him, but what possible motivation could there be to make such an offer to King Solomon in the first place? But leaving that question aside, Solomon says, what do I want? I want wisdom. Lev shomel ishpot atamcha, wise heart, to be able to judge your people, ishlavin ben tov lava, so I can discern between good and evil. And God says to him, wow, what a request. You didn't ask for wealth and you didn't ask for honor. You know what? I'm going to give you all three. You get the chachma, and you get the osher, and you get the kavod, you get the whole thing. And Solomon says, great, wonderful. And there's no price tag. It's free. There's no price tag. On what? On his three gifts. Which are what? What are his three gifts? Chachma. Osher. Kavod. Small price to pay. I'll come back to the price tag. I'll come back to the price tag. You're right, but I'll come back to the price tag. Gives it to him on a silver platter. Chachma, Osher, and Kavod. Right? Silver platter? Not so fast. Chachma. Chachma. Osher, what do you do with wealth?
Enjoy.
Enjoy. And essentially, how do you achieve covenant in this world? By building. And who are the big? Who are the most respected people in the world? Businessmen, because they've got the money. Right. The world respects wealth. So the wealthier you are, the more you can do, the more you build, the more you achieve, the more covenant you have in the world. It's fascinating to me that Solomon is given three gifts at the start of his life on a silver platter. And at the end of his life, talk about kriyat tov, talk about ingratitude. At the end of his life, those are precisely the three arenas that Shlomo complains about bitterly because they bring him no satisfaction whatsoever. So what happened to King Solomon? Did he get a free gift or didn't he get a free gift? He asked for Chachma, he got Chachma, Osher, v'Kavod, and at the end of his life he complains, no, a whole life of Chachma, Osher, v'Kavod, and it got me nowhere. This is the problem. Yes, sir. You've been waiting so patiently.
Well, it says he woke up and it was just a dream.
Oh.
So it really
wasn't
off.
No. It says that God came to him in the middle of the night in a dream. God appears, God's prophecy, God's communication method to anybody appears on different levels. To Yosef, God came to him in a dream. To Shlomo, God came to him in a dream. Because he's not in the status of a Navi. A Navi, there's a more direct form of communication. Moshe, there's even a more direct form of communication. But there's no question that it's a direct dialogue with God. It's a real dialogue. It's not a fiction. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in the Navi.
It was a dream.
Yosef also had dreams. And behold, woke up, and behold, there were dreams. But they were real dreams, meaning there were a real communication between God and an individual. Just the vehicle was a dream. There's no question they're real.
Isn't there just a tremendous lack of gratitude?
It's enormous. It's really quite
that's my heart.
Heavy. Absolutely.
Now go one step further. Yes.
If David didn't merit to build the base of Megiddo because he had blood on his hands, he was a warrior, whatever, Shlomo's out marrying all these non-Jewish people. He's amassing horses, and the Torah tells you don't amass horses.
So do you want me to break the do you want me to break the myth now, bust the myth now, or should we wait a few weeks?
He didn't have any horses?
No, it had nothing to do with Solomon. The myth that I was going to bust is why David didn't build the temple. The reason why David did not build the temple had nothing to do with blood on his hands. And in fact, open up the book of Shmuel, and I would challenge you to find anywhere where it says that the reason why David doesn't build the temple is because he has blood on his hands, and you won't find it. When David comes to the request to build the temple, the response comes from the Navi, Natan. Natan comes to him and he has an entire speech why he can't build the temple. It's chapter 7 of Shmuel Bet. And in that speech there is not one word about war or blood. Where does that come from? It's not a myth completely. Where does it come from? It comes from Divrei Hayamim. It comes from when Solomon is recounting to the people why his father was denied the opportunity to build the temple and he would had to do it in his stead. Solomon says, it's because my father was a warrior and had blood on his hands. But that's a very different perspective than the Navi's articulation to Solomon, to David. Why? Why does it change? I think it changes for a very simple reason. What God actually says to David, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but since you raised it, I'll address it here. What God actually says to David is, the reason you can't build the temple is because the temple can only be built by a king. So you'll say, David was a king, right?
Yeah.
Not quite. What's the fundamental difference between a king and a shofet? King goes to war, shofet goes to war. King judges his people, shofet judges his people. King is a political leader of Israel, so is a shofet. What are the two? There are two fundamental differences, but one that's particularly relevant here.
Hereditary.
Excuse me?
Hereditary.
A dynasty. Shofet is not a dynastic position, it's not an inherited position. The Malchus is. Saul was anointed king of Israel. He was demoted to the position of a shofet after the story of Amalek by virtue of the fact that he did not have his son sit on his throne. David does not become the first king of Israel until Solomon sits on his throne. Which is why every time there's a reference, Shlomo Melech makes reference to the chesed that God did to David by putting a son on his throne, because that essentially solidified David's position as the first king of Israel. I'll show it to you. Take a look. We're already here. Let's.
Does that not make Solomon a king until his son sits on the throne?
No. It's the beginning of a dynasty. Once you start the dynasty, the dynasty starts. So now David is the first king of Israel, and now everybody comes after him. He's a melech. The temple, by definition, is a palace. And the palace can only be built by a melech. We will address that in much more detail later in Kohelet. It's really an issue we'll get to in chapter 5. But since you raise it here...
And all the other averos that Shlomo did that...
First of all, they're at the end of his life, not at the beginning of his life. And second of all, God promised David that Solomon would build the temple. But I'll show you the passage. You should know this. This is a fundamentally important piece, because we often quote the idea that David couldn't build the temple because he had blood on his hands, and I'm not sure it's accurate. I think when Shlomo says to the people, David couldn't build the temple, what is he going to say? David couldn't build the temple because he wasn't really a king until I sat on this throne? Can Solomon say that to the people? Of course not. So he gave a different reason for it, which may also be true, but it's not the real substantive message of the Navi. The real issue of the Navi, take a look in chapter 7. Shmuel Aleph, chapter 7 for a moment. Sorry, Shmuel Bet, chapter 7. Sorry. My mistake. starting with verse 11, Pasuk Yud Aleph. From the day that I established leaders, political leaders over Israel, and gave you respite from all your enemies, God has now promised you that God will make you a bayit. How does God make David into a bayit? A house. In the Malchus is a dynasty. When you will die, and I will give you seed after you, and I will establish that seed that comes after you, and I will establish his Malchus, as we said at the end of chapter 2, he will be entitled to build a bayit for my name. And I will establish his kingdom for eternity. I will be like a father to him, he will be like a son to me, meaning, if he sins, I will punish him, but I will never take the kingdom away from him, as I did to Saul. And your kingdom will therefore be established forever. And your throne. The focus here has nothing to do with dam or war. The focus here has to do with dynasty. And the status of David as a king when Solomon sits on his throne. So the issue isn't so much merit, of who merits to build the temple, as much as the right time in history to build the temple. But you have segued us into a very interesting issue, which is that this dream, if we go back to Melachim Ala Paragimel, this dream of Solomon's, that he has, where God comes to him and he says, ask of me anything and I will grant it. The critical moment here, the context here is very important. What's happening? What is Solomon doing here at this moment that this dream comes to him? He goes down to Givon and brings 1,000 sacrifices for a reason. This isn't an accident. What's he about to do? He's about to build the temple. He's going to embark on the first most important mission that he was left by David. His mandate, his agenda, if you will, as king, is to build the temple. He goes down to Givon because the temple had not yet been built, and there are batmot, and there are high places, so that's where the altar is, and he brings 1,000 sacrifices. That's essentially a way of saying, right, we start now. So they are about to embark on the building of the temple. And God comes to him and he says, ask of me anything you want. What's the connection? And he says, I want Lev Chacham. And God says, oh, together with Lev Chacham comes two other things. Namely, Osher and Kovan. Now, so God says to Shlomo, I'm very happy that you didn't ask for Osher and Kovan. It's very nice. It's very, very nice. But you understand, of course, that Chachma goes together with Osher and Kovan. With the right amount of Chachma, you achieve both Osher and Kovan. They're usually linked. Not always, but usually. So Solomon asked for the right one. Of the three, he asked for the right one. If he would have asked for Osher and Kavod, I'm not sure the story would have ended the way it did. He asked for Chachma. Good, God says, fine, I'll give you Chachma. But it goes together with that which he didn't ask for, which is Osher and Kavod. You want to?
Well, he asked for Chachma because that's the way he solidified his kingdom. If he hadn't then judged the women fighting over the baby and pressed the world, his people, that he was wise, they wouldn't have been loyal to him. His 100%. Wisdom is his whole source.
100%. Absolutely. From Solomon's perspective, it was the right answer because it was the answer to the question of how do I be king? Right? Mm-hmm. In other words, Solomon is hearing
You were about to be king of Israel. What do you need to be a successful king? And he answered that question. But I'm not convinced that that was the question God was asking.
But not everybody asked for the same thing, because Yerucham didn't say he wanted Chachma. In fact, he ignored the advice of the elders, which...
Yerucham never had this option. He was
But I'm just saying, so not everybody would have asked for that, even given that option, because he thought, oh, more tax.
Right. My issue isn't what anybody else would have answered to this question. The only other person to whom I would ask what his answer to this question would be is David. Mm-hmm. And I will answer that question. What David would have answered to God's question, I will answer that question, if not today, then next week. Because I think I have an answer to that question.
So you're implying his request was not the right request.
That's exactly what I'm implying.
Oh,
yes, absolutely. Because it says, why did God like it? Because he asked for Chachma instead of Usher and Kavod. But what if he would have asked for none of the above? What if he would have asked for something else entirely?
Righteousness?
We're not going to answer yet what he should have asked for. I just want to register the possibility that God was happy because he asked for Chachma over Osher and Kavod, but not objectively the right answer in principle. And I'm going to prove it to you. I'll prove it to you. Can I erase this? Too late to answer that question. Solomon's request. Solomon's request. Read it to me.
I'm a little guy.
Read it to me. Solomon's request. God comes to him and he says, what do you want? Lev? Lev? Let's do it this way. Lev? Shamea, Ishvot, et Amcha. Go on. Tohavin, and Tov, Lara. Solomon's request? Correct? That's what it says. Somebody read me Hashem's response. Vayitava davar b'nei Hashem. Yan, what does he say to him? Yan asher sha'alta to davar hazeh. Because you have made this request. V'lo sha'alta lecha yamim rabim. You didn't ask for longevity in your kingdom. V'lo sha'alta lecha osher. And you didn't ask for riches. V'lo sha'alta lecha nefesh oivecha. Success on the battlefield. V'sha'alta lecha, what did you ask for? Havin? Mishmoa?
Mishpat.
Now, look at this very carefully and tell me if God rephrases Solomon's request correctly.
Yeah, the word lahavin.
Didn't add the word lahavin. The word lahavin is there.
Beginning at the end.
Correct. Solomon asks for Lev Shomea, which we translate as understanding. For the purpose of Mishpot, to judge. And then he adds Lahavin. Then Tov Lava, between good and evil. Everybody with me? God rephrases his request and says, okay, Solomon, you did good, okay? Meaning, Lahavin, Lishmo Mishpa. One, two,
1, 2, 3.
God takes three words out of Solomon's request and rephrases them. Lev shomea lishpot etamcha lehavin ben tov l'ra. Says God, what is his request? Lehavin, to understand enough to judge your people. Lehavin lishmo mishpat. But God leaves out a phrase. A phrase with Solomon stuck in and God took out. Namely, Ben Tov. Doesn't sit well. Doesn't sit well. Why not?
That's what God does.
Very, very close. Because that's what God does. Stuart, you said yesterday about last week about playing God. Lahavin ben tov l'ra is a formula that is dangerous in Tanakh. Because lahavin ben tov l'ra is remarkably and far too close to Eitz Hadat Tov l'ra. To request the Eitz Hadaat, to request the knowledge of good and evil, was the one thing that in Gan Eden was proscribed from Adam. Wasn't allowed to have the Eitz Hadaat. He could have the Eitz Chaim. As long as he stayed in Gan Eden, the Eitz Chaim was fair game. He could have the Tree of Life, but not the Eitz Hadaat. The Eitz of God, of Da'at, was off limits. Why? We're going to digress for a moment. I'm going to introduce a concept in the story of Gan Eden. We'll come back to it next week. But let's understand the Eitz of Da'at for a moment. There is a myriad of interpretations in the story of the Eitz of Da'at. I like one. I have always bought one. Because it's the one that I have most easiest time to get my head around. And that's Rav Hirsch. It's built around a Radak, but essentially it's Rav Hirsch. What is the Eitz Hadaat Tov Vara? What does the snake say to Adam? The snake says to Adam, or to Chava, actually. Says, you know why God doesn't want you to eat of the Eitz Hadaat? Because on the day you eat of the Eitz Hadaat, v'ayita ke'elokim yod'ei tov v'ra. Because you will be God-like. God doesn't like competition, says the serpent to Adam. And the day you eat of the Eitz Hadaat, you become God. And that's why God didn't want you to eat of the Eitz Hadaat. It had nothing to do with the Eitz Hadaat. The Eitz itself, Tov L'Machal, Tov L'Maskil, it's good, it's pretty, it makes you wise, it's attractive, it's tasty, it's got Alamailas. What's wrong with it? You know what's wrong with it, says the serpent? If you eat the Eitz Hadaat, you become God. Ve'yita ke'alokim. Simple question. The snake right? I bet you've never been asked that question before. Was the snake right? Raise your hand if you think the answer is no. Raise your hand if you think the answer is yes. Should I prove it to you? Open up. Bereshit Perek Gimel. Start with what the serpent says. Perek Gimel, Pasuk Dalet. Ki yodeh Elokim. Vayomer ha-nachash al ha-isha, the nachash says to the isha, lo mot t'mutun, you are not going to die on the day when you eat of this tree.
Ki yodea Elokim, because God knows. Ki biyom acholchem mimenu v'nifkechu enechem, the day you eat of this tree, your eyes will be opened. V'yitem ke Elokim yodei tov v'ra. And you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Did I describe what the Nachash says correctly? Mm-hmm. So Nachash says to them, if they eat of the tree of knowledge, they will become God-like. Or they will become Ke'elokim, like God. So I asked the question, was the serpent right? Take a look at Perek, same Perek, the end. Pasuk of Bet. After they eat of the Eitz Hadaat. They've eaten of the Eitz Hadaat. God has punished them. He's punished the Nachash, and he's punished Adam, and he's punished Chava, and he's given them clothes, and he's done the whole geshäft. Now what? Vayomer Hashem Elokim, Pasuk of Bet, listen carefully. Says Hashem Elokim, Hein ha'adam haya ke'echad mimenu lada'at tov vara. Now that man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. V'ata pen yishlach yado v'lakach gam me'etz ha'chayim v'chal v'chal yolam. Now, lest he set forth his hand, send forth his hand and eat of the tree of life, and live for eternity. V'yishalcheyu Hashem Elokim migan Eden. So God expelled him from the Garden of Eden. La'avod et ha'adama shelukach misham, so that he can work the fields. Vayegaresh et ha'adam, expels man. Vayashken mikedem legan Eden et ha'kruvim, and he placed east of the garden to protect, to guard its entrance. He placed there, caused to dwell there, the kruvim. Vetlat ha'cherev ha'mitapechet, with the fiery turning sword. To guard the entrance of the tree of life. There are two trees in the center of the garden, the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. As long as man was prepared to stay away from the Eitz Hadaat, he could eat of the tree of knowledge as long as he liked. The tree of life as long as he liked. The moment he ate of the tree of knowledge, he was expelled and the protection was placed around the tree of life. The rest of the garden doesn't matter. The rest of the garden is irrelevant. The only thing relevant are the two trees, Eitz Hadaat and Eitz Chayim. Man ate of the tree of knowledge, he ate of the Eitz Hadaat, he lost the right to Eitz Chayim. Without getting to the whole issue of mortality and its role in the story. So I asked the question, was the serpent right? Does man become God-like when he eats of the tree of knowledge? Absolutely. Ribbono Shel Olam himself says, now that he's eaten of the tree of knowledge, he has become like one of us. He has become godlike, lest he set forth his hand and eat of the tree of life and live for eternity. What's bothering the Rebbeinu Shem? So what's so terrible if man lives for eternity? Would it be such a terrible thing? What's going on here? So here's the thesis. It's a powerful, powerful thesis. The Mefarshim split over the question of whether the Eitz Hadaat had any magical, mystical powers. Does man acquire knowledge by eating the fruit of a tree? No. What man gains by eating the fruit of the tree is not knowledge. It's authority. The issue of knowledge of truth and of good and evil has got nothing to do with knowledge. It has to do with authority. It has to do with who is the determining authority on the definition of good and evil. Who makes the rules? Who decides good and who decides evil? Who is the melech in this world? Yeah. And as long as man is prepared to recognize that man is not the melech in this world, that God is the melech, that God is the authority, that God makes the decisions of right and of wrong and good and evil in this world, man can live in the Garden of Eden and he can eat of the Eitz HaChayim and he can live for eternity because he's prepared to acknowledge God's mastery. Simple equation. Yodei Tov V'Rasus of Hirsch is not knowing God, good and evil, it's the determination of good and evil, it's the authority over good and evil. What does the snake say? That authority belongs to you.
That authority is godliness. If you eat of the tree, you usurp that power. You become the arbiter of good and evil, right and wrong. You become godlike by determining what is right and wrong in this world. Chava eats of the knot of the tree. Adam eats of the tree. And the result is they have made that decision to dethrone God and to enthrone man as the arbiter of good and evil. Now the Ribbono Shel Olam has a problem. Namely, how do you separate the God from the mortal, from the human being? And that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam said to Adam. You take of the Eitz HaDaat, I take away the Eitz HaChayim. You can't have both. One way or another, you will recognize God's authority in this world. If you're prepared to accept it willingly through the Eitz HaDaat, Tov. And if not, then you will accept it unwillingly through the Eitz HaChayim. But you can't have both. Not in this world. It's either the Eitz HaDaat or the Eitz HaChayim.
Go back to the board. What was Shlomo asking then?
One second.
How do you ask?
I'll come back to the board. Shlomo Melech is offered the request of requests. He's offered Sha'al Ma'aten Lach. Whatever you want, it's yours. Why Solomon feels the necessity to jump back to the world of Gan Eden, we will explore next week. But for some reason, Solomon feels it necessary to take himself back to the world of Gan Eden. And in the world of Gan Eden, there are only two possibilities. There's the Eitz HaDaat Tovara, and God's authority, and man's authority. There is the Eitz HaChayim, and the acceptance of God's authority. And what does Shlomo say? Ribbono Shel Olam, you've given me a request to become, you've given me the option to become a good, a powerful king. You've offered me the option of how to become this powerful king in the world. Well, I'll take that option. Lev Shomea Lishpot Adamcha, to judge your people. But with it, I want something else. To judge your people, to lead your people, to lead the largest, most powerful empire in the world, I need something else. If I'm going to be king over the largest empire in the world, I become the most powerful person in the world. I need to understand the world. I need to have the whole world. What's the expression? In my hands?
Mm-hmm.
That's what he needs. Lahavin ben tov lara. I need to understand the Eitz HaDaat. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, you want the Eitz HaDaat? Isn't that? Eitz HaDaat comes with Olam Hazeh. It's a package deal. It's this world. You want that authority? You can have it. It's a package deal. It comes with Chachma. It comes with Osher. It comes with Kavod. The only thing it doesn't come with is long life. The only thing it doesn't come with is Eitz HaChayim. One second. Now finish the parak. Let's go back to Melachim Aleph. Go back to Parak Gimel. And read the end of God's response. Pasuk Yud Dalet. Well, let's start from Yud Gimel. Gam asher lo sha'alta natati lach, I will give you that which you didn't request. Gam osher v'gam kavod. Pasuk Yud Dalet. Ve'im telech bidrachai lishmor chukai u'mitzvotai, kasher halach David avicha, if
you will follow David's footsteps and follow my laws, my statutes, my commandments, my authority, then v'ha'arachti et yamecha, I will give you long life. Eitz HaChaim is conditional. We'll come back to this next week because we haven't answered the key question, which is why on earth Solomon is standing in Gan Eden. How did Solomon get to Gan Eden? That question I haven't answered. But that's where Solomon is standing. And he's been offered the same request that Adam HaRishon was offered. The same choice. Sha'al ma'aten lach. And like Adam HaRishon, he fails. He took the Eitz HaDaat over the Eitz HaChaim. God says to him, do you want the Eitz HaDaat? He says, hey, that comes unconditional. But the Eitz HaChaim is conditional. And at the end of Solomon's life, what haunts him? Death. Because he never got the Eitz HaChaim. And he recognized too late that the Eitz HaDaat without the Eitz HaChaim is meaningless. And that's the theme of Kohelet. I said in the very first class we had that Kohelet addresses two themes: the definition of Tov and Ra, and the meaning of life under the shadow of death. The anchors of Sefer Kohelet from start to finish are the two trees of the Eitz HaChaim and the Eitz HaDaat. Because that was what started Solomon's life. And that's where he fell. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, we start from this point. How did Solomon get to Gan Eden? And remind me at the end of the shiur, remind me if I don't get to it, to answer the question of what I think David's answer to that request would have been. We will adjourn here.